Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, to ask a question, you may press star and then one. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now I'll turn the meeting over to your host, Ms. Amy Friedrich. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Allie. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Amy Friedrich. I'm one of the organizers for today's call. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webinar is DHS-DMH Training for New Rule 132 Providers. The presenters will be from the Division of Mental Health, Bureau of Community Services, Dr. Mary Smith, Associate Director of Decision Support, Research, and Evaluation, and Leanne Reiner, Clinical Policy Specialist. And from the Collaborative, Sue Kappas, Clinical Services Manager, Renee Potter, UM Team Lead, Britt Sparlin, Clinical Care Manager and HLOC Team Lead, Trish Gorda, Business Systems Analyst 2, and myself, Amy Fricke, Training Coordinator. Today's training will cover the following topics: via overview of the registration process, Provider Connect, authorization process, service matrix, consumer eligibility, an overview of the claims process, and resolving claim issues. We will take a short break around 3:15. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful housekeeping items. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed, which is 888-997-9863. And the passcode is Illinois. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to see the webinar PowerPoint presentation, the login information is located on the invite you received after you registered. If you are experiencing any problems with that particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the webinar ID, which is 470-833-618. There will be a designated question and answer portion at the end of each presentation today. The operator will open up the lines for questions at that time. And lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please take a brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take less than 5 minutes to complete the survey, and we value your feedback. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Mary Smith.
Thanks, Amy. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. So I just wanted to give a very brief overview of a couple of issues related to the registration process. As Amy noted, she'll be covering the registration process and access to Provider Connect in detail and providing a demonstration. But there are just a couple of things I want to highlight based on questions that we've received from providers who have participated in this training previously. Now, as I noted yesterday during my overview of the collaborative, DMH contracts with the collaborative to implement policies and procedures that have been developed by the Division of Mental Health. And so with regard to what we're covering today, the collaborative is basically implementing DMH policies around consumer registration. So as you know from participating yesterday, the first major prerequisite, this was covered by Rich Jones, you must be enrolled with both HFS and DMH and the collaborative in order to submit a registration, in order to submit a claim, and in order to submit an authorization. No matter what happens, also, all individuals must be registered. So this also includes individuals for whom you contract with an MCO to provide services. Both HFS and DMH require that those individuals be registered with the collaborative. As I said, the registration is a prerequisite for submitting claims and authorizations. as we walk through the process today, you'll see that the registration is comprised of demographic information, some descriptive information about the individuals that you serve and that we're purchasing services for, and then also some clinical information such as diagnosis, functioning, and a host of other items. Staff at DMH use this information for monitoring, we use it for federal reporting, and we use it to evaluate the impact of services across time. As Amy talks about the re-registration process, you'll see that there are some variables that have been identified by both consumers, by other states, and by DMH as key indicators that relate to recovery. It's important to pay particular attention to Amy as she talks about some of the prerequisites for registration, which include Social Services Package B, making sure folks have that, and then also making sure that you have obtained the correct and an accurate RIN for individuals. You really need to be sure to have access to the HFS MEDI system and then also to the DHS eRIN system. But again, Amy's going to walk through some detail. It's also important to recognize that, you know, you have a limited amount of time to submit a registration. It's best to submit the registration as soon as possible within the timelines, because typically we do not go back and permit any retroactive dating of registrations or submissions of registrations outside of the period that DMH has established. Just a couple of other points. You are part of a group of providers that can provide services to individuals who have Medicaid coverage only, meaning, you know, as I'm sure you already know from working with Rich, you have no grants or non-Medicaid dollars allocated to provide services to individuals. And so that means it's incumbent upon you to check individuals' eligibility and make sure that they are enrolled in Medicaid before you provide services. Those are the only services that we can reimburse you for. Those are the only services that will make it through the HFS claim submission system. If an individual is on spend down, you know, I'm sure you already know this, but be aware if the person is on spend down and they have not met the amount that they have to meet, then they may go in and out of Medicaid eligibility, in which case DMH will still pay for services while a person is actively enrolled and eligible for Medicaid. So again, just a reminder that we're reimbursing for the Rule 132 services. So I think that's it. We'll switch over to Amy to walk us through Provider Connect, which I can't emphasize enough. Please pay attention to this part, too, because you can't submit registrations without it. And again, if you're not enrolled, if the consumer's not enrolled, if the registration is not up to date, then you can't submit claims. So we depend a great deal on the information that makes up the registration process. So I think that's about it, Amy. Let me turn it over to you to walk folks through Provider Connect and the registration process.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Smith. I will start by giving you an overview of Provider Connect. Provider Connect is a free online secure application. It is a portal into the collaborative's MIS system and is accessed via the collaborative's website. Today, we will review how to access Provider Connect, how to register, re-register, and close a consumer's case, and what resources are available to you. There are several tools available within Provider Connect. These include the ability to register a consumer, view consumer registration status, close a registration, view authorizations, view and print authorization letters, access and print forms, and submit inquiries to customer service. There are several benefits to using Provider Connect. It is easily accessed through the collaborative website at www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com. It allows for multiple transactions to be completed in one session. Information may be viewed and printed, and being able to access this portal reduces calls for routine information. In order to access Provider Connect, you must first be enrolled with the collaborative and HFS. You must also have a provider ID number assigned by Value Options. To obtain a provider ID number, contact National Networks at 800-397-1630. Each provider is allowed one Provider Connect logon ID. For more than one provider logon ID, you will need to contact the Value Options EDI Help Desk at 888-247-9311 and press option number 3. The Help Desk is available from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. Please note that there is a 48-hour turnaround time when requesting additional logon. Before you can access Provider Connect, you must first register as a user by taking the following steps. Go to the collaborative website and click on For Providers. This brings up the Provider Online Services page. Click Register, and you will then be taken to the Provider Online Services registration page. Complete all applicable fields, and note that all fields with a red asterisk are required fields. Please keep the following requirements in mind when creating your password. Passwords must be 8 to 20 characters in length, must contain one number 0 to 9, must contain one uppercase letter A to Z, must contain one of the special characters shown here, and passwords must not contain any spaces. Also know that passwords are case sensitive and expire every 90 days. This slide shows what the provider online services screen looks like. This is where you will register for a password and log into Provider Connect. Registering consumers is important as the information submitted during registration is used for enrollment of individuals for DMH purchase services to determine the eligibility group for which the consumer is qualified, which in turn determines what services DHS and DMH will reimburse. Before you can register a consumer, you must first obtain a consumer REN, which is a recipient identification number, and DHS Social Services Package B, also known in the VO system as STBO from HFS. This is accomplished through the eREN system, which can be accessed from the DHS website. Registration information will be updated within 5 business days. VO process registration and assigns fund. VO sends fund information to HFS within 1 business day. HFS processes the registration and sends results to VO by the 2nd business day. There are several scenarios where you will need to access the registration screen. When registering a new consumer and closing a consumer at the same time, when registering a consumer who has been previously closed, when re-registering a consumer which is required every 6 months to maintain eligibility for submission of claims, and when closing a registration of a consumer. When we begin the live demo, I will show you 2 methods for accessing the registration screen. The collaborative highly recommends that you use the specific member search option for the following reasons. This option verifies that the consumer is on file with the collaborative, and when you navigate to the register screen after searching for the consumer, many of the demographic fields will have been pre-populated for you. Choosing the register member link without first searching for the consumer will require all consumer demographic information to be entered before the system can determine if the consumer is on file. Before we begin the live demo to register a consumer, I'd like to point you to the Provider Connect registration guide dated June 13 version, which is available on the Collaborative's website. Simply click on For Providers, then the provider information link to the left, then the document can be found in the registration section. Or you can access the guide directly by using the web address shown here. The Provider Connect guide provides an overview of the registration process and a detailed description of information required to complete the registration process. Now we will begin the live demo. This is the Provider Connect login screen that appears when you select the login from the Provider Online Services page of the Collaborative website. Before I log in, I'd like to point out the contact information below the Register button under New User. This is the number you would call for assistance with any Provider Connect access issue. Once you log in, the user agreement page will appear. Read through the agreement and then click I agree at the bottom of the page. A pop-up will appear. Just simply click OK. This is your provider homepage. You will see links to the left and under the message center. The links to the left include options for specific member search, and right below that, register a member. As I previously mentioned, the Collaborative highly recommends that you use the specific member search option rather than register a member. Let me enter this consumer ID. And date of birth, they are required fields. And please note the format for the date of birth. Give it a few minutes to load here. This brings up the consumer demographic screen. You will see four other tabs here that you can reference at a later date that include enrollment history, COB, benefits, and additional information. To begin the registration process, you'll need to scroll down and click View Consumer Registration. If no existing registrations are found for the agency, a No Records Registration message will appear in the consumer registration list. We need to click on Add Consumer Registration. Please note the following. As you can see, some of the different demographic fields have pre-populated since you searched for a member prior to registering. Any fields that are pre-populated can be overwritten as needed. All fields with an asterisk are required and must be populated. If you try to move on to the next screen without completing a required field, the field heading will turn red and an error message will appear at the top of the screen. We will now select the registration date. I will use today's date. See, the recipient ID is already pre-populated. I just want to mention that I'm using all test data today for demonstration purposes. The agency fee is the agency's 9-digit federal employee identification number. The satellite code is an optional numeric value between 00 to 99. The Medicaid site ID is the HFS-assigned Medicaid site ID number where the client is registered. The last name is the consumer's legal name. First name would be entered there. Date of birth is already pre-populated for us. Mother's maiden name. This is the legal maiden name of the consumer's mother. If this information is not known, just simply click unknown. The Social Security must be valid or click unknown. Gender, male or female. Moving on down to primary address. Again, if the address is not known, you would just go over here and click address unknown. Just select a county here and a township. And this is where you will indicate if the consumer is a Williams class consumer or not. We're going to select no for today. Household income is the total monthly income of all family members in the household at the time of registration. You'll just round to the nearest dollar. Same for the client income. You would indicate the household size here and the household composition here. Moving down to education level. Select high school diploma, military status, we're going to put not a veteran, and marital status, never married. For employment status, we're going to put not in the labor force. And for SSI, the Supplemental Security Income, we are going to select eligible and receiving payments. The DFI and CFI is a donated funds initiative. This is the contracted funds initiative enrollment status. So we're going to select not applicable. Court forensic treatment, we're going to select not applicable. For the race section, all 5 fields are required. If one race is noted, all others can be 98, which is nothing to report. Citizenship, we're going to select U.S. citizen. Language, we're going to select English. Interpreter service not needed. MH residential arrangement, we're going to put private residence unsupervised. And justice system involvement, we're going to put not applicable. The DMH special projects indicates either the disaster that brought the consumer to Illinois or the SMRF initiative. There's the selections that you have in the drop-down box. I'm going to leave it blank for today. Consumer third-party payer, I'm going to select no. And MH residential indicator, I'm going to select no. That takes us to the special program enrollment, and I'm going to select no for each, juvenile justice, PATH grant, Region 1 crisis care, ICG, and CHP. I do want to make mention that the Region 1 crisis care system is the CHIPS program. The CHP is the community health prevention. Okay, moving on down to consumer in residential or Northwest crisis care. Going to select not in a residential program. For permanent supportive housing, I'm going to select no, and money follows the person, I'm going to select no. The MH closing information is gathered when closing a registration. Since we are not closing a registration today, I'm going to leave that blank. I do want to note that you have two options here at the bottom, which is if you click the cancel button, please note that all information entered on the registration will not be retained. So, and if you click next button, this will bring up the select funds page. But before we move on, I would like to demonstrate what happens when you leave a required field blank. Let's see, we'll select this one. As you can see at the top, the field that is required that we left blank is indicated up here in red. It is also highlighted on the page where we need to put in the information. Once you do that, then click Next. On the Select Fund screen, the system will automatically default to the eligible funding sources, as you can see here. Then click Next. The selected funding sources screen will display with effective and expiration dates. Please note, at this point, it is not guaranteed that the consumer will be registered for any or all of these funds. At the very end of the registration process, you will be informed if the registration has been approved and the exact funds that will be assigned for that consumer. Click Continue. You will enter the diagnosis code and first presentation assessment information in the required field. Again, the information that I'm using today is just for training purposes. Okay, and then we're moving down to axis 3. We're going to select high blood pressure, hypertension. The principal diagnosis indicator, we're going to select axis 1, diagnosis code 1. And then we're going to move down to first presentation assessment. I'm going to mark yes in each of these and click Next. Now we are at the functional scales. Enter the appropriate GAF or CGAS score and LOCUS results. C will automatically be selected for the consumer if under age of 18. G will automatically be selected when the consumer is 18 or older on the registration start date. Just go through and select the appropriate drop down in these sections. And that takes us down to the LOCUS results. You'll enter the functional impairment and assessment scores here. And you'll see that the composite score is automatically calculated. LOCAS recommended level of care is also automatically populated, determined based on the composite score. See that here. However, you can manually change it if needed. Select high intensity here. Scrolling all down. The assessments applies to minors only, so we're going to leave that blank. And we're going to click next. This takes us to history of illness. So you'll go through again, read each of these, and select which is applicable to the consumer. Same with the co-occurring disorder, evidence-based practice. And then click Next. This takes us to the MH cross disabilities. Going to select today's date. Indicate the primary caregiver age. Type of service needed. And then click Next. This takes us to the guardian information. And we're going to leave that blank for today. Scroll to the bottom and click Next. Consumer registration confirmation screen will display. The status is approved. This shows that you have successfully registered for the funding sources listed on the screen. Funding sources listed will be only for Medicaid. I'm going to click Return. And I'll now demonstrate how to re-register a member. Again, we are on the home page. Scroll down to View Consumer Registration. And now you will see everything that the consumer is registered for. Here is where you will re-register the consumer for each particular registration. I'll click that just to show you today. Re-registration is used to re-register a consumer and update key fields to extend coverage every 6 months. Re-register a consumer, update key fields, and close the registration at that time. Example, if the previous registration on file for the consumer was past the six-month timeline at the time of re-registering, the consumer will no longer be receiving those services. Re-registering a consumer, you update the key fields and end date of a special program. For example, when a special program is being closed and a consumer needed to be re-registered for other funds. This is where you would do that. I'm going to go back to the home page, and after arriving at your home page and clicking the View Consumer Registration button again, I just wanted to show you here, this is where you re-register, close a registration, or make any address changes. There is a consumer registration record for each fund for which the consumer was registered. Any of the records that were re-registered buttons appear can be selected to re-register all funds. Click on the applicable re-register button. Okay. And then here, as I pointed out, this is where you will close a registration. Once you click that button, it will bring up the consumer registration page. And this is where you will fill out the information and close the registration. The end date of a special program, this will be selected for special programs only. The consumer will still be registered for all other registered funds. Both end date and a special program and close the registration, this will end the special program on the end date specified and close the other registered funds on the closing date. If the special program is being ended on the same date that the registration is being closed, then both can be closed or ended by entering the MH closing date below the special program. It is also important that consumer status be updated when he or she is no longer enrolled in a special programs or when the consumer is no longer being seen for services. Okay, after arriving at your home page and clicking just one moment. All right. Finally, I want to discuss the multiple RINs resolution. You will need to call the collaborative at 1-866-359-7953 and select the provider menu, then press 1. A collaborative eligibility specialist will then work with DMH. DMH directs the collaborative to keep or merge each RIN. How to handle consumer name and date changes. The consumer's name and date of birth that the collaborative has on file is received from HFS. If the consumer's name or date of birth is incorrect, the correction needs to be made with HFS. HFS will then notify the collaborative through the eligibility file we get from them daily. One moment while I pull the PowerPoint back up. I also want to indicate at this time that all of the PowerPoint presentation and the MP3 will be downloaded to the collaborative's website so you can use for future reference. I just want to point out that this is the customer support telephone numbers, and again, that will be on the PowerPoint that will be posted. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Trish Gorda, Business Systems Analyst 2, who will cover the batch registration.
Good afternoon, everyone. During this portion of the training, we're going to review what you'll need to submit batch registrations, and I'll walk you through the screens to submit a batch registration file. To have a complete understanding of everything you'll need to know to successfully submit batch registration files, you'll need to refer to the batch registration submission guide on the collaborative website. In the guide, you'll find information on obtaining a submitter ID and password, file specifications required for your batch file, such as the file type and file length, and trailer record specifications. You'll also find the batch file layout showing field names, field lengths, positions, and descriptions. And you'll find information on error processing, such as error codes and descriptions. In the last demo, Amy showed you how to register an individual consumer using the online registration screens in Provider Connect. In this portion of the training, I'll show you how to submit multiple registration records on a specially formatted batch file using the batch registration submission process, which is also available in Provider Connect. First of all, I wanted to show you where you can access the batch registration submission guide. It can be found on the collaborative website in the provider information section. And as you'll see from the slide, we've also got the website address here. So now I'm going to walk through the batch registration submission process in Provider Connect. So we're going to start from your Provider Connect provider home screen, and we're going to select the EDI homepage option on the left-hand side of the screen. From the EDI homepage, you can submit a new batch file here. You can see the batch files you've previously submitted in this section. And then you can also retrieve response files down in this section. We'll get to response files in more detail in a few moments, but for now, you would select the Submit Batch File button. In step one of the process, you would select Batch Reg from the Form Type drop-down field, and then click the Next button. In step two of the process, there are no options to select on this screen, so you're just going to select the Next button again. In step three of the process, you're going to click Browse, and you're going to locate and attach your batch file. Once you've selected your batch file, then you're going to click the Submit button to submit your batch registration file. In step four of the process, we see that our file was submitted successfully and that we'll receive an email shortly containing the batch registration submission number. But don't celebrate just yet. Your batch file may have been successfully submitted. However, the file still needs to pass several file formatting checks. If any one of these checks fail, your batch file will reject. In other words, just because you see this screen saying the file was submitted successfully and you received an email with a submission number does not mean that your batch file was accepted. You must download the summary response file coinciding with the submission number to verify that your batch was accepted. If the summary file shows that the batch file was rejected, you'll need to correct the batch file and resubmit. There are several reasons why your batch file may have rejected. The first, your batch file may not be formatted correctly. If that's the case, then the summary file will show the message invalid file format. or the trailer record may not be forwarded correctly, or it may not exist at all. As I mentioned earlier, successful batch submission depends on meeting the file specifications and batch file layout found in the batch registration submission guide found on the collaborative's website. Your batch file will reject if it does not meet these file specifications. So whether your file rejected or not, the next step now is we need to retrieve those response files. So you're going to receive up to 3 response files for each batch file you submit. You're always going to receive a summary response file, which will indicate whether the batch file was accepted or rejected. If your batch file was rejected, this is the only response file you'll receive. The reason the batch file rejected will be shown on the file when you open it up. If the batch file was accepted, the summary response file will indicate the number of registration records accepted and the number of records in error. If your batch file itself was accepted and your batch contains registration records that were accepted, you're also going to receive an accepted response file. If none of the records in your batch were accepted, you won't receive this accepted file. And finally, you might receive an error response file, which contains all registration records that were rejected. If any of the records on your batch were accepted, if all of the records on your batch were accepted, then you will not receive an error file. If your batch file is accepted, and some of the records on your batch are accepted and some are rejected, then you are going to receive all 3 response files. You'll receive a summary file, an accepted file, and an error file. And I can't stress this enough. It is absolutely critical that you download these response files as soon as you receive them to ensure that any rejected batch files or registration records are corrected as soon as possible and resubmitted. So now I'm going to show you how to retrieve those response files. To do that, we'll go back to the EDI homepage, and again, you can get to that from your provider home screen. You'll find your response files in the incoming files section, the bottom of the screen. Our example here shows 3 files. I know it's probably kind of hard to see the text of the file, but the example shows 3 files that all contain the same batch submission number. So I can assume that I have all 3 response files, a summary file, an accepted file, and an error file. And as I said, you can tell that because the submission number is the same in each of the file names. Again, you'll need to refer to the batch registration submission guide for specifics on the response file naming conventions. You'll also notice that each file name ends in a different letter, and you'll be able to see in the guide, it'll tell you exactly which type of response file ends in which letter. So the first file you're going to want to download is the summary file, which will tell you if the batch itself was accepted or rejected. So you would click on the hyperlinked file name to download it. In the next screen, you would just click on the file name again. And if the response file downloaded successfully, click the Yes button and you'll return to the EDI homepage in case you have more response files to download. However, if you get an error and the response file did not download successfully, you can click the No button and you can try to download the response file again using the EDI, or you can try downloading the file directly to your computer by right-clicking the file name and selecting Save As. And of course, if you need assistance submitting your batch file, you can contact the EDI Help Desk at the number shown here. And now I'd like to turn the call.
Operator, we'd now like to open the lines for questions at this time regarding Provider Connect and batch registration.
All right, thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly. Your name is required to introduce your question. Now, to withdraw your request, press star two. One moment, please, for the first question. Our first question is from Mr. Michael Behart. Sir, you may begin.
Yes, my question is concerning the spend down. For individuals who have a spend down, would we bill for the services provided in order to help them meet their spend down?
You can bill for any Rule 132 service for which the person is eligible. Are you asking if DHS takes into account the mental health billing that helps an individual to meet the spend down?
Yes, I'm wondering about, I'm used to it from the other side, helping an individual, you know, meet their spend down in order to get their services covered. So if we're working with somebody and providing them then with mental health services and they have a spend down, we won't get reimbursed, or will we get reimbursed for all of the services that we provide?
Well, you get reimbursed. It might seem a little circular,
but
if a person meets their spend down, you'll get reimbursed for the mental health services that you bill for.
I see. So if we bill the individual for the services enough for them to meet their spend down and they paid us directly, then they would be able to do that. How would we be able to indicate that they've met their spend down through payments they've made to us?
I'm probably going to take this question down and go back and get some and put together a written response for you. But basically,
okay,
you're not indicating to, you know, when you submit your claim, you're really not indicating to anyone that a person's met their spend down. An individual's eligibility is really given to us by HFS. And so, you know, we don't determine eligibility. We don't use information about whether or not a person's met the spend down. You know, that information just has to be submitted, and we simply receive the status of an individual. So when I did my overview, I just simply wanted to remind providers that, you know, if a person doesn't have full coverage, there may be times when they don't meet the criteria for full coverage, and you just need to be aware of that. Unfortunately,
okay,
we don't control the eligibility or anything. We receive that information from HFS. I will, however, I understand your question. I will, however, take it back to DMH staff, and we'll see if we can put together something.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question is from Ms. Margaret Holden. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, this is Margaret with Riverside Medical Center. You guys mentioned that a status needs to be updated when a patient's no longer receiving services. With our crisis residential center, we're seeing folks 3 to 5 days. Do I need to update that at discharge?
Yes, that would be true.
Okay. And then I have one more. Is that allowed?
Well, I guess so. Sure.
Thank you so much. The next question is Access 1, Access 2, and Access 3. Do you just want the admitting diagnoses, or do you also want the other diagnoses that drive that admitting diagnoses in those fields?
You can make up to 3 diagnoses on each of those axes. We are looking for you to indicate the primary diagnosis.
Okay, so the primary goes on axis 1. Is axis 2 and axis 3 the diagnosis backing up that prime, or still the same diagnosis?
Well, I think axis 2 actually covers personality disorders, et cetera. And
okay.
Axis 3 right now, still with DSM-4R, would be medical conditions. The Axis 1 permits you to enter 3 diagnoses on Axis 1, you know, as defined by DSM-4R.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. There are no questions in queue. Ma'am, you may begin.
Amy, before we move on, I just want to clarify one thing for folks. You covered the information about multiple RINs. Agencies may, or providers may, understand what that means, but they may not. So I just wanted to take a minute to clarify that. DHS assigns RINs to individuals. And if a person does not have a RIN or Social Services Package B, as Amy covered in her presentation, you would need to make a request to DHS for a RIN. You'll always need to check and make sure a person has Social Services Package B, which is also obtained from the eRIN office. If you don't, we won't be able to process the registration because an accurate RIN and Social Services Package B status is required to process a registration. Although DHS is very careful about assigning RINs because we try to make sure there's one unduplicated number that relates to each individual, there can be some occasions when an individual has more than one RIN. That might happen if, for example, someone requests a RIN for someone and they give an inaccurate birth date or a middle initial or a nickname instead of the full first name. In those events, you'll really need to work with the collaborative, as Amy said, or directly with the DHS eRIN office so that all of those multiple RINs can be consolidated into one. And that really saves you a lot of headaches because we'll only process claims and registrations with the one RIN. So I think, Amy, that's about the only clarification I wanted to make. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. We will now move on to consumer eligibility, which is the authorization process and utilization management. Leanne Reinert will be the presenter, and she is DMH Clinical Policy Specialist. Leanne, you may begin.
Thanks, Amy. Can you see my screen?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. As Amy said, this is Leanne Reinert, Clinical Policy Specialist within the Bureau of Community Services here at DMH, and I also spoke for a while yesterday about Rule 132 services and promised you that we were going to get a lot weedier today, so this is where it starts. I'm going to talk to you first about eligibility requirements and then also about our utilization management policies. So we're going to start with the eligibility for community services, and as you can see, we have both financial and clinical eligibility criteria that the individual consumer must meet in order for the Division of Mental Health to reimburse care. Those are defined in great detail within our provider manual, but I'm going to hit some of the highlights for you today. But again, you want to make sure that you become very familiar with our provider manual for all of the information that you're hearing over the course of these 2 days, because there's a lot more detail there. You've just been hearing from the collaborative about their system and how you provide information to us. When you provide that information, that's what we use to then establish which eligibility group an individual qualifies for. And then once we know which eligibility group the individual falls into, that determines what services we will pay for. And if the person does not have Medicaid, it determines what amount we'll pay for the service, because depending on their income, we may not pay our full rate for their services. They may be responsible for a portion of it. So we look at an individual's household income and size. That helps to determine the DMH rate for services that we pay for individuals who do not meet the criteria for Medicaid. It determines which group they fall into. If individuals don't fall into our eligibility groups, or if their income is too high, then we do not reimburse any care for those services. So it is important that as you start to serve individuals and look for DMH reimbursement, that you really understand the eligibility. I'm having a little trouble advancing my screen here. There we go. Okay, so eligibility group one, these are individuals that do have Medicaid. And in addition to having Medicaid, the individual has to be in need of mental health services for either an already diagnosed mental health disorder or...
Excuse me a minute, Leanne. Uh-huh. I just want to see if you can enlarge your screen. We are only seeing part of the slide.
Okay. It's showing the whole slide on mine, so let me see what I can do here. Does that help? Is that any better, Amy, or is it still the same?
No, that is still the same. We can just see community services and then dash ELI, which I'm assuming is for eligibility, and it just seems off-centered.
Okay.
And I did confirm with a few others that that is only what they are seeing as well.
All right. Trying to figure out if there are other ways that I can change it. Not giving me any other options, and my screen shows the whole thing. Rich, if you're on the line, would you see if Doug might have any other suggestions for how we can enlarge my screen here?
Leanne, I think the collaborative might have a copy of your presentation.
I absolutely do, Mary, and I can pull that up if that would be helpful, Leanne.
Yeah, if we can't get this fixed, I prefer to go through it myself if I can. But let's see if we can get Doug to help us here for just a second. Yeah, I see my whole screen here.
Head over to the left.
I can't do anything with it that way.
This is in that go-to meeting, isn't it?
I've tried both of these, show my screen and show my screen clean, and they're...
This is what we see. is part of it.
Yeah. Let me see if I can...
I can move your whole screen over.
It might help if you have to.
Lee, and this is Amy. If you go back to the screen you were just on, I think if you click View, that might be an option.
Sorry, Margaret's punching things for me.
Okay.
I think in a minute those will just go away on its own.
Okay, I'm not going to be able to change my settings without completely logging out, so I guess we're going to have you guys go through the slides for me, Amy.
Okay, sure. Or if you pull that back up and hit View, I'm seeing if that might help. Because we could see your when you had it
this
minimized, I could see the entire slide.
When I had what minimized?
The previous screen rewrite where it shows this. The slides off to the left.
What screen she's talking about? Right there?
Yeah, so try to hit View and when you're in that area. Go up and select View. And then...
Fit to Window?
Yeah, Fit to Window.
Now what do you
see? You're on normal.
You see it now?
Nope, that's the same. Oh, well, it was worth a shot.
Okay. Sorry, everybody.
Okay. That's okay. I will pull it up on my end.
Okay. I mean, did you take control back or do I need to do it?
I will do it.
Okay.
So the first one that you was this the authorization process?
No, the eligibility ones.
Consumer eligibility.
Yep.
Okay. Where View. Where is it? Where's full screen? Okay, can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. What page were you on, Leanne, or would you like me to start?
Just go to the second slide, please, and we'll see if that's where we were at. So the next slide.
How do I get to the next slide? Left click?
All right. Okay, so sorry about that. So we were talking about eligibility group one. Again, these are individuals who do have Medicaid, and they also must either have a mental health diagnosis or a suspected one. And we do have a list of those diagnoses in our provider manual. The list is pretty extensive. And then they, for DMH to reimburse under Medicaid, they can't be enrolled in any of the HFS managed care programs. If they are, then they then all of their services are covered through the HFS managed care program and not by DMH. Again, you have to enroll and or register them with us through the collaborative and be eligible under the state's Medicaid program. You can go on, Amy. For eligibility group two, first of all, these are folks that do not have Medicaid coverage. However, they do have significant mental health issues. So we are looking at individuals that we diagnose, that we consider to either be an adult experiencing a serious mental illness or a child with a serious emotional disturbance. So they are, again, in need of mental health services for their diagnosis. They have to be enrolled with us, and they have to meet the diagnostic, functional level, and treatment history criteria, which are going to be on the next slide. Amy? Thank you. For adults, we're looking at what we refer to as our target population. Again, serious mental illness, which we define, as you will see, with emotional behavioral functioning that is so impaired that it's interfering with their capacity to live in the community without the supportive treatment of the mental health center. We're looking at both severe and persistent impairment that's resulting in limitation of capacities for things like their activities of daily living, their ability to seek or receive assistance that they may need in order to stay in the community. You can go on, Amy. We then have the diagnosis list. Again, this is a more limited diagnosis list than our larger eligibility diagnosis list that we use for the Medicaid population. This is really, as you will see, centering in on the more potentially impairing diagnoses, such as the psychotic disorders and significant mood disorder. You'll also see the eating disorders and PTSD listed. You can go on, Amy. Then they must also meet either criteria under this number two or Roman numeral three. For criteria two, we're looking at their treatment history, which could include some continuous treatment, some residential treatment, a number of inpatient treatment episodes, or a history of outpatient services that's lasting at least a year, continuously or intermittently, that includes things like psychotropic medication management, outreach, those types of things. Okay, Amy, you can go on. Then if they don't have the criteria under Roman numeral two, we will look for functional criteria. And for these, they have to have at least two of those. So you'll see we're looking at various functional areas, social, occupational, school, someone who's having difficulty with maintaining employment, can't maintain their public assistance without some assistance from some type of social service agency, not seeking services when they're needed, lacking support in the community, that type of thing. You can go on, Amy. If an individual doesn't have current functional impairment, let's say that they have been in treatment with your agency for a while and so your treatment is effective, then we would still consider them to meet the criteria for functional limitations if they are currently in treatment and have a history within the past 5 years of meeting some of those functional criteria that we just went over. and that there's professional judgment that if they were to stop getting the treatment that's being provided, that they would again experience those functional impairments. Okay, Amy, we can go on. For what we consider children, birth up to through 17 years of age, so until their 18th birthday, our target population we define as serious emotional disturbance. So we are looking at similar factors, but as they would relate to children. So again, we're looking for, first of all, the diagnosis. You can go on, Amy. You'll see that the diagnosis list is similar. There are a couple of extra diagnoses added in here, the ADHD diagnosis as well as Tourette's. Go on, Amy. And now, because we're looking at the children's side of the treatment history, there's slight differences here related to children, but it's the same general idea. Go on, Amy. And again, because we're looking at children, we may not yet see all of the functional impairments, but we do look for functional impairments in at least two areas. First, the functional impairment must be the result of the mental health problems that the child is either or will be receiving care for, and would be expected to persist if the child did not receive treatment. Go on, Amy. The areas that we consider for functional impairment include self-care, community, social relationships, family, and school. Go on. Then for eligibility group three, this group is our what we refer to as our first presentation of psychosis group. When we had some reductions to our budget a number of years ago that required us to reduce the services we were able to provide to individuals without Medicaid, we wanted to make sure that we preserved services as much as possible for individuals who were experiencing their first episode of psychosis, but without treatment would likely continue to decompensate and eventually would end up in that eligibility group two, because they would eventually develop the functional impairments. But if this is their first episode of psychosis, it might also be the first time they've been hospitalized, and they might not yet have experienced a course of illness significant enough that they would meet all of our functional criteria. So we didn't want them to not be able to access services that our target population would access, because we know that if individuals get treatment early, that we can have success in intervening and perhaps stopping that more progressive course of illness. So we developed this eligibility group. Can you go back, please? We developed this eligibility group to address those issues. So again, we're talking about someone who does appear to have a mental disorder and need treatment for it. They have to be enrolled with us. And then we have specific age, diagnostic, and treatment history criteria for this group. And they have to meet all three of those things in order to be in eligibility group three. Okay, Amy, you can go on now. So first of all, you'll see that the diagnostic list, we're looking specifically at individuals with some type of psychotic symptoms, so diagnoses of schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or bipolar with psychotic features are the diagnoses that we're looking at. Also, it's important to note that this diagnosis has to be given by a psychiatrist. For the rest of the services in DMH and doing your registrations and all of that, Rule 132 allows for an LPHA to do the diagnosing, and as we talked about yesterday, the LPHA is a broader credential than just a psychiatrist, but for eligibility group three, you have to have documentation that this diagnosis was done by a psychiatrist. Okay, Amy, we can go on. Next, we're looking for either minimal or no prior mental health treatment, again, because we're looking for that first break psychosis. And specifically, we're looking for individuals that have not been prescribed more than 16 weeks of antipsychotic medication, because we're looking for that first break. Also, no history of autism, pervasive developmental disorder, mental retardation, or organic brain issues such as trauma or tumor that are requiring ongoing primary services for any of those problems, because we want to rule out that that's the reason for the treatment. Okay, Amy, go on. All right. For eligibility group four, this is our non-Medicaid eligible population. So we are using our larger list of diagnoses for these individuals, but this is a more restricted benefit package than is available for our target and our first population individuals. Okay, you can go on, Amy. So again, they're not Medicaid eligible. They have a qualifying diagnosis as listed in our large diagnostic list, have a significant impairment in an important area of life functioning, and must meet our financial criteria, which is less than 400% of federal poverty level. And again, we have a graduated scale based on that income level as far as what percent of our rate we will reimburse for these non-Medicaid groups. Okay, you can go on, Amy. Our service benefit packages, I referred to this a little while ago. For group one, for the Medicaid folks, they are eligible for any medically necessary Rule 132 service. For group two, which is our non-Medicaid target population, as well as group three, which is our non-Medicaid first presentation group, they can receive as much crisis intervention as is needed, as well as limited amounts of mental health assessment, case management, psychotropic medication services. If you look in the provider manual, it will give you the exact amounts of each of those services. For group four, the non-Medicaid eligible population, again, they can receive crisis intervention as needed, and then they have limited amounts of mental health assessment with the focus on trying to identify what other types of treatment might be out there that would be of some assistance to them in their community. All right, Amy, we can go on. Okay, so we're going to switch over to the other slide deck. Amy, the utilization management slide deck?
Yes, one moment while I pull that up.
Okay. All right, so we can go on to the next slide, Amy. Okay, what we're going to talk about right now is the Division of Mental Health Utilization Management Program, which we developed over the course of the last probably 7 years or so now. And this utilization management applies to individuals who are Medicaid eligible, receiving Rule 132 services that are reimbursed by DMH. So again, if you have some individuals whose care is reimbursed by DMH and other individuals whose care is reimbursed through an HFS managed care program, the HFS Managed Care Program has their own set of utilization strategies, so this only applies to the individuals for whom DMH is reimbursing care. So we developed the utilization management program to ensure that the individuals for whom we are purchasing care are receiving the services that are best suited to support their specific recovery, as well as the preferences they have for their treatment, that the services are cost-effective and provided in the most appropriate setting, and that the services are consistent with medical necessity criteria, as well as evidence-based practices wherever those exist. We implemented this program to try to strike a balance between the needs, preferences, well-being of the people being served, demonstrated medical necessity, and the availability of resources within the public system to purchase that care. What we don't do with the utilization management program is we do not limit medically necessary Medicaid services. Also, our utilization management program is completely compliant with our Illinois Medicaid state plan as well as all associated federal rules. Okay, you can go forward, Amy. So there are three components to our utilization management program. First, we have medical necessity guidance and criteria. We have a manual that we have developed, and it is available on the website for your review. We also have some limited external authorization that we have the collaborative do for us, and I'm going to talk about the policies, and then the collaborative staff's going to go through exactly what's required and able to obtain one of those authorizations. And then finally, we do ongoing data reporting and analysis of that data to look at the system and how services are being utilized and whether or not our resources appear to be being utilized appropriately. Okay, Amy, you can go on. So for the medical necessity guidance and criteria, we published medical necessity criteria for specific services. As you'll see, it's a much shorter list than the list of services that are defined by Rule 132. These are the services that we identified as needing to have this guidance either because of utilization patterns or other concerns that we had at the state level on resource utilization. So assertive community treatment and community support team are two intensive team services. Both have criteria published, and then three of our other services, psychosocial rehabilitation, community support, and therapy counseling, each have their own set of medical necessity guidance and criteria. And for these services, the ones that are available to both adults and children, there are separate criteria provided for each. For psychosocial rehabilitation and assertive community treatment, those are only adult services, so the criteria you'll see will just be for adults. But for community support team, community support, and therapy counseling, those all have criteria that have been developed specifically for adults as well as specifically for children. Okay, Amy. Again, you can find the criteria in our DHS DMH Medical Necessity Criterion Guidance Manual, which is a chapter within our provider manual. You need to use these criteria to guide in making consistent admission, continuing service, and termination of service decisions for each consumer, not just for the ones that may fall under the utilization management guidelines. And we may look at our medical necessity criterion guidance guidelines as a part of our post-payment review to be sure that your clinicians are prescribing treatment according to the medical necessity criteria, even if we are not looking at it from a utilization management perspective from the authorization side of things. Okay, Amy. For limited external authorization, Again, this is work that the collaborative does on our behalf. We require it for specific services, and we selected those services based on a review of service utilization patterns prior to implementing the authorization process. We have the same thresholds for adults and for children, and those thresholds are calculated by provider and consumer per fiscal year. So if you have an individual that's coming into services with you and may have had services at another provider within that same fiscal year, any services at the other provider will not be considered when we're looking at their utilization at your agency. In order to get paid beyond the established threshold for services, you must get that authorized by the collaborative prior to providing the service, and the collaborative will authorize the service so long as you are able to demonstrate medical necessity for the service for that individual. Okay, Amy? This table here is just to help you to see when you must get authorization. So as you see, ACT and CST require authorization at the time of admission, so that means that all ACT and CST services require authorization. And then we also have continuing service authorization, so if you get to the end of an authorized period for ACT or CST, you have to seek another authorization. For PSR, psychosocial rehabilitation, community support group, and therapy counseling, we allow an amount of those services to be provided before an authorization is required. So for psychosocial rehabilitation and community support group, you can provide up to 800 units combined between PSR and CSG before you need to seek an authorization during that fiscal year. And our fiscal year starts July 1. Then if an individual is going to receive beyond 800 units, PSR and CSG combined within that fiscal year, you must seek an authorization in order to get reimbursed for that. For therapy counseling, we allow 40 units, which is equal to 10 hours of therapy counseling, before any authorization is required. So then you do have to have a continuing service authorization if you're approaching that 10th hour of therapy counseling and are not going to be terminating with the individual, are going to be continuing, then you need to seek authorization beyond that 40 units. All right, Amy, we can go on. Okay, and then the final prong, the ongoing data reporting and analysis, we look at things like utilization patterns for specific services. We may look at post-payment review results, the impact of our authorization activity currently, any other quantitative or qualitative aspects of service delivery. Then we use that data to do a few things. We do some technical assistance for providers as needed or indicated in the data, may do some training, as well as we might modify our utilization management program for a future fiscal year based on analysis of data. All right, Amy. Okay. Our medical necessity criteria for each of our services, it will follow the same general format. You'll first see that there's a diagnostic requirement, then there are criteria established to begin that service. So regardless of whether the service has an admission authorization or maybe one of our threshold services or may not have any authorization requirements at all, you still need to have your LPHA considering, does this person meet service initiation criteria for this particular service at the time that they're signing off on your mental health assessment and treatment plan, because this is what defines whether or not the service is medically necessary for that individual. Then we have continuing service criteria. So if the individual has been receiving the service for a while, this is guidance on whether or not that service should continue based on medical necessity. Exclusion criteria means that this service is not going to be appropriate for the individual and should not be considered. And then finally, service termination criteria. When is the service considered no longer medically necessary, and is it time to stop? All right, Amy. So you'll see consistently across the medical necessity criteria for each different service that we're looking for a current eligible mental health diagnosis for which the proposed course of treatment has been determined to be effective, that the individual's symptoms as documented in their record and as the clinician who's doing the evaluation sees are consistent with the DSM or the ICD diagnosis that's been given, and finally that the symptoms that are being addressed by the service don't have their primary origin in either an autism spectrum disorder, a substance-related disorder, or primary diagnosis of an intellectual disability. This does not mean that you can't provide mental health services to someone who has a co-occurring disorder. You can provide mental health services to someone that has any of these co-occurring disorders, but when you're providing mental health services through Rule 132, the service that you're providing has to be targeting the mental illness and not the other co-occurring disorder. All right, Amy. Our service initiation criteria, this, again, is to be considered for all individuals receiving the service for which guidance is published, and, again, may be subject to post-payment review, and this is what establishes the basis for the need for the service in the beginning. And then continuing service criteria, again, is something that will be utilized to determine need for ongoing service once an individual meets thresholds for for that authorization. And this is what the collaborative uses to base their authorization decisions for those services that have thresholds and then require an authorization. All right, Amy. And exclusion criteria and termination criteria, we went through that. The reasons why it wouldn't be appropriate, reasons why you should discontinue it. At the time that another arm of the collaborative is doing post-payment review, they might cite that exclusion criteria, also might be cited at the authorization review. Termination criteria, you might see cited at the time of provider monitoring. If there's a clinical practice guidance review that happens, they might cite that if it appears that it's time for an individual to be terminated from a service and they haven't been. All right, Amy. I took some of the content on the slides that we're going to go through now, verbatim from the manual, and then others were paraphrased so that we could get this presentation done within the time that we have, because we still need to have the collaborative actually walk you through how you get the authorizations. So, again, just want to strongly encourage you to review the Medical Necessity Criteria Guidance Manual in its entirety. Make sure that you have a full understanding of our requirements as you're going forward. Okay, Amy. First, for therapy counseling, we're looking for severity, complexity of symptoms, level of functional impairment require this service. If the individual, again, has an emotional disturbance or diagnosis that's destabilizing or distressing, that their assessment identifies specific mental health issues that can be considered to be effectively addressed through therapy counseling, and we're looking for a LOCUS level of care score equating to 2 or higher for adults, clinician-rated Ohio scale of 16 or higher for youth. Okay, Amy. If the individual has been receiving therapy counseling and now it's time to look for an authorization to continue past that threshold, The continuing service criteria, we're going to look for evidence that the individual has been actively participating in the treatment, that there is a demonstration that there has been significant benefit of the service as the individual is attaining treatment goals but hasn't quite reached the outcome that's desired, and that the individual continues to experience some destabilizing symptoms, as we talked about in the initiation criteria. And finally, that the individual cannot be safely and effectively treated solely through the use of other types of services and use of natural supports. Okay, Amy. Then we also list individual additional criteria for the specific modalities of individual, group, and family. So we're looking for, in the individual case, there's necessity of one-to-one intervention. If it's a group, we're looking for evidence that the group process will be beneficial to the person. If it's a family modality that's recommended, then we're looking for problems that are exacerbated by the family dynamics. Okay, Amy. Exclusion criteria for therapy counseling would be if the individual has a significant cognitive impairment or mental status or developmental issue that makes it unlikely that they're going to benefit from the treatment, or if the primary problem would be more effectively addressed by a different type of treatment. All right, Amy. And our service termination criteria, if the individual's treatment goals are achieved, the majority have been achieved, and the remainder can be safely achieved without the service. Or, on the other hand, if there's been no significant improvement, then the individual should be reassessed for a different type of treatment, because if there's been no progress at all with therapy counseling, then why would you continue therapy counseling? You should be looking at, is there a service that would more effectively meet the person's needs. All right, Amy. For PSR, psychosocial rehabilitation, we're looking for significantly impaired role function in at least two of the areas you will see there. And this service is supposed to be a targeted skills training service for individuals with that significant impaired role functioning. So that's why we're looking very specifically at those functional areas. The individual has to have a LOCUS score equating to a level of care of 3 or higher, which is high-intensity community-based services. And the discharge transition plan that the individual has needs to be focused on increasing community integration through the application of the skills that are being addressed in PSR into community settings. All right, Amy. So if the individual gets to their combined 800 units or 200 hours of PSR and CSG to continue receiving that service, we want to see that there are modifications in the PSR services addressing specifically skills that the individual has not yet been able to successfully demonstrate that have been the focus of PSR, and again, that the individual cannot be safely treated through the provision of community-based services or natural supports. Amy? Exclusion criteria. This is only a service for individuals over the age of 18, so that's the first one. If an individual is not choosing to participate in PSR, then that would be an exclusion criteria. If the primary reason for the dysfunction that's being addressed is something other than a mental illness, then PSR is not the appropriate mode of treatment. If the individual has sufficient ADLs and skills to enable progress in recovery, then PSR, this intensive skills focus, is not what is necessary. Or, on the other hand, if the individual requires more intensive contact than the more of a classroom facility-based setting of PSR, then PSR would not be the appropriate mode either. All right, Amy. And finally, service termination criteria for PSR. If the individual has developed the skills or requests termination, no longer needs that treatment, then they should be terminated from PSR. If they've learned most of the skills and can improve their skills in natural settings, then that classroom-based PSR is no longer necessary. And on the other hand, if they've not made any progress at all, then there should be a reassessment to figure out what is it that the individual actually needs, because PSR doesn't seem to be helping. All right, Amy. For community support group, we're looking at significant impairment in function and the inability to apply skills that maybe they learned in PSR in natural settings, or to build and utilize those natural supports. We're looking for the requirement of small group interaction to facilitate the development of those skills. And we're, again, looking for specific functional impairments that can only be remediated through the small group practice. For community support group, the individual needs to have a locus level of care recommendation of 2 or higher. All right, Amy. For community support team, these criteria are defined within Rule 132. And I gave you the site there of exactly where it's at. Some highlights of it is that they have to have the Rule 132 eligible diagnosis and symptoms that are consistent with that diagnosis. They need to require team-based outreach and support and be expected to be able to access and benefit from a traditional array of psychiatric services if they have that team support, and have tried and failed to benefit from less intensive services, or have been considered and found inappropriate for less intensive services. So they've either had a trial of those services, or for some reason it's been considered, but it's not considered to be sufficient given their current situation. All right, Amy. Okay. Then we have a whole list of additional things that, and they must meet 3 of. We went through this a bit yesterday in the community support team service definitions, so I'm not going to go through them all again today, but you can see them on the screen, and certainly you can look that up in the rule or in our medical necessity criterion guidance manual. Go on, Amy. Okay. Then we're looking for at least one or more of the following related to the complexity of symptoms and level of functional impairment. So we're looking for a treatment history, significant problems in the community with homelessness, arrests, that type of thing. We're looking for a locus level of care of 4 or higher. And if the individual does not have a locus level of care of 4, then you would have to do a justification of the need for service if their locus level of care recommendation is less than 4. We do have one or two providers that do CST for youth, so we do include an Ohio scale score of minimum of 16 for problem severity on the workers form for the Ohio scale if you were to develop a youth CST team. Okay, Amy? Exclusion criteria for CST is if they have sufficient daily living skills that they can make progress in their recovery with support of other non-team-based services. If their level of impairment makes it unlikely that they would benefit from the services, or if they require more intensive service such as ACT. All right, Amy. And termination criteria. They've achieved their goals and no longer need that active mental health treatment, or they've achieved most of their goals and they've got a plan to facilitate to less intensive services, or again, on the other hand, if they're not making any progress in treatment, if there's not been significant improvement, then you may need to consider. Maybe they need a more intensive service such as ACT. All right, Amy. And finally, for ACT assertive community treatment, again, these eligibility criteria are very specifically defined within our rule. You'll see that the list of diagnoses is very short for ACT. We're looking at specifically at psychotic-type disorders. You need to be able to show that the individual's symptoms are consistent with one of those diagnoses on that short list. And again, that the symptoms that are being addressed have their primary origin in that diagnosis and not in one of the co-occurring disorder diagnoses. Okay, Amy? Okay, for ACT service initiation, we're looking to see that the individual has agreed with the need for and choice of ACT, has been actively involved in development of the plan. They're 18 or older because, again, ACT is an adult-only service affected by serious mental illness that requires assertive outreach and support in order to remain connected with necessary mental health and support services to achieve stable community living. So this is the crux of ACT. It's assertive engagement for individuals who have not benefited from more traditional mental health services. All right, Amy. Okay, we went through this when we talked about ACT yesterday, so I'm not going to go through it in any detail, but it's up there on the screen for you again. The number of factors that are indicators that an individual may be in need of ACT. Go on, Amy. The functional impairments, they have to meet at least one of the conditions listed there, either severe difficulty consistently performing the range of daily activities, severe difficulty in their other types of functional roles, such as employment or homemaking activities, or in educational placement if it would be, you know, a younger person that is maybe trying to go into higher education is having difficulty there, or extreme difficulty with achieving safe living situations, so maybe loses their housing, gets evicted over and over again. For ACT, the individual must have a locus level of care recommendation of 4. All right, Amy. A few more things that we're looking for. There has to be a current treatment plan that includes a discharge or transition plan. Even if it is a year down the road or even farther, we expect that the treatment plan is looking towards the time when the individual will no longer require ACT and is planning for the individual to be integrated into community-based services. We're looking for evidence that the individual is only going to be expected to make progress in treatment through that highly coordinated team that includes the medical services of the psychiatrist and the nurse, as well as all the other specialists that are involved in an ACT team, as we talked about in yesterday's training. And finally, that there's no other less intensive service, such as a community support team, that would be able to meet the individual's needs. All right, Amy. Gave you some examples of continuing service criteria for ACT, so things such as they continue to have impairment requiring the ACT level of services, that they've benefited from the service but continue to need that level to make progress towards their goals, et cetera. Amy? We would consider the following to be exclusion criteria for ACT if the individual has sufficient skills at daily living, that they can make progress in their recovery through less intensive services, then they should not be receiving ACT. If they have a level of impairment that makes it unlikely that they could interact with the ACT team, then ACT is not the appropriate service. And finally, if the individual needs a more structured and direct supervision, such as what is found in a residential treatment setting, then ACT is not appropriate because ACT is an assertive community-based service, meaning that the individual must be living independently in order to receive ACT. All right, Amy. Finally, our discharge or termination criteria. Once the individual has achieved most of their goals and is no longer in need of this assertive outreach-based service, then they should be discharged from ACT and transition into other levels of care. Or if they're not experiencing any progress at all, then again, you need to consider, is there another type of service, perhaps residential, that the individual needs at least for a period of time? Or if the individual moves out of the ACT team's geographic area, cannot be located in spite of repeated ACT efforts, then they need to be discharged from your team and removed from your roster, as that is one of the things that we track, is how many individuals are on a specific ACT team. All right, Amy? All right, so just a couple notes about the authorization process before I turn it over to the collaborative folks who are going to go through this in more detail. All team services require authorization from the initiation of service. So if medical necessity is demonstrated, assessment and treatment plan are completed prior to the authorization request, then the collaborative will authorize ACT for up to 1 year, and they can authorize CST for up to 6 months. If, on the other hand, you request the authorization prior to completion of all the documents, then the collaborative can authorize that initial authorization for only 3 months, and then you have to request a continuing service authorization to continue the service. We do that for these two services, again, because they require authorization from admission, so we have a way to streamline it for you if you have somebody new and you want to make sure that they're going to be authorized for the team service as you're starting the service. You can get that done even before you've completed all of your treatment planning, but then we still need you to do that and then go for the continuing service authorization. Also, for team services only, the collaborative can backdate to the initiation of services, again, within a time frame. They can backdate services. So if you start your comprehensive assessment of the individual that it's been determined you're going to be providing ACT for, you can get that started and then go in and register the person and seek the authorization, again, within time limits, and the collaborative will go through all of that with you. For the threshold services, that's not allowed. You must request the authorization before you exceed the units, or anything that where you exceed the units before your authorization is requested would not be reimbursed. All right, Amy. Okay, again, therapy counseling. A reminder that individuals who are eligible, meaning that therapy counseling has been found to be medically necessary, can receive up to 10 hours or 40 units of the service without any authorization. If at the point that they're approaching that 10-hour, 40-unit threshold, your clinician determines that it's going to be necessary to continue beyond that threshold, then you must obtain that authorization prior to providing services in excess of that threshold in order for those services to be reimbursed. And the determination of how many hours or units will be authorized is based on the medical necessity for each individual. So it's not like there's a set number of 10 more hours that's authorized for everybody. It's individualized according to what the individual's course of treatment is and where they're at in their treatment and how many more hours of therapy they're going to need to meet their goals. All right, Amy. For PSR and CSG, again, these are handled in a combined fashion. So eligible individuals can receive up to 200 hours combined, or 200 hours of PSG or PSR, or 200 hours of CSG, or any combination of those two. If they are approaching that 200-hour threshold and are continuing to need those services, then you must seek an authorization. And again, the number of hours that will be authorized are individually determined based on the demonstration of medical necessity. All right, Amy. So just a couple more things, and this is just your overview. The clinical care managers are going to review the documents that you submit to make sure that you've demonstrated adherence to medical necessity criteria as we've published it, as well as Rule 132 requirements. If those criteria are met, then the collaborative is going to enter an authorization. Again, in order for the provider to be reimbursed for services provided past initial thresholds, you must request the authorization and get it approved prior to service provision. So you want to submit the authorization request before the authorization expiration date or before that maximum number of hours or units stated has been reached. All right, Amy. We also have created within the collaborative an audit process. This is to ensure that the medical necessity is actually there in the records for all individuals. We did this to streamline the process so you no longer have to submit as much documentation to prove medical necessity. However, it is always possible that an individual request for authorization may be selected for this random audit. And if it is, then you will be informed by the collaborative that you need to submit additional documentation to support the medical necessity information, and the information that you would submit would include a mental health assessment, a treatment plan, and then any other progress notes or pieces from the individual's record that your LPHA believes is particularly relevant and helpful to establishing medical necessity for that individual. All right, Amy. If the collaborative denies an authorization for any clinical reason, there is the opportunity to appeal that denial, and they're going to explain that process in detail during their portion of this training, and it's also described in detail if you would receive a denial, then you receive a letter from the collaborative, and that appeals process is spelled out in detail there as well. All right, Amy. Okay, so that's the end of my overview of our policies. Amy, I'm not sure if we're going to go on with collaborative staff now or if we're going to take questions.
We can open up the lines for questions at this time, operator.
Yes, ma'am. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question and record your name. Star 2 to withdraw your request. One moment, please. Our first question is from Mr. Gong Nim Mu. Sir, your line is open.
Yes, I just got a question, actually, just like my observation regarding the diagnosis to establish the eligibility. And in the documentation, it basically said in order to meet the target population criteria, you know, the client must have one of the diagnoses that designate you know, in the list. In our experience of a registration, you know, we just want to caution everybody that this diagnosis, you know, must be designated as a primary or principal diagnosis. Otherwise, when a collaborator processes the registration, even though, you know, Axis 1 has three diagnoses, if the targeted diagnosis not designated as principal diagnosis, and it will not count it as a target diagnosis. So just one of my observations I want to let people know. And yeah, that's my observation on this.
Right. Mary,
and also, also a suggestion, when the next revision of the documentation is, you know, please clearly state it that instead of one of the diagnoses, you know, in the list, it says, you know, the diagnosis must be, you know, principal diagnosis for the focus of treatment. Because I got a lot of user, you know, many user use our system. I got a lot of, you know, questions on this.
Thanks,
Dongmin. Just an, actually, I want to mention another, a couple other things regarding registration. Because the reason I participated, because one of the new users is going to use our system for the registration and billing. You know, on the registration, the address field, it cannot use a special character. So that's one thing. Another thing is a commonly made mistake is that a co-occurring disorder. I think Dr. Mary Smith, you mentioned that in a technical call in the past. This co-occurring disorder does not mean the client has a co-occurring disorder. It's actually trying to look to see whether the client has been screened for co-occurring disorder. So a lot of people turn, you know, use like a no. Actually, it should be most situations, yes, because in the mental health assessment, you know, clients are screening for co-occurring disorder. So that's something I want to mention. The other thing on the registration, you know, batch registration, I do want to compliment, you know, the provider Connect. They are doing a great job in terms of accepting batch registration. You know, all our users use our system. You know, we have about, you know, 50 users, nearly half of the agencies. We never have any problem submitting the batch registration and download the result. You know, this part I do want to, you know, thank Provider Connect. You know, they handle the batch file very well. So actually I got a phone call from the Provider Connect Option IT Director. You know, he and I talked about this. I said, you know, the batch registration really goes very well. And regarding the download the result file or response file, and do make sure the users, you know, they may get a fake path. That has nothing to do with the valid option. That really has to do with your local computer allow you to download the local file or not. Okay. And usually the file, the result file is available at the hour. It turns out that the valid option usually process the registration file by the hour, like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, you know, 11 o'clock. So if you submit a registration batch file before the hour, it should be probably 10 minutes after the hour should be available. Okay. So that's some of my observations, and just, you know. One more thing regarding the ring. And if you get the ring, and you probably wait a couple of days to submit the registration, because if you submit too quick, the Provider Connect does not have data passed. HFA has not got a chance to pass the data to, you know, Provider Connect yet, so you would get an error message that client not found. So, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Ms. Margaret Holden. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hi, this is Margaret with Riverside. Our question is, when we have to verify income, how do we do that for our patients? What if they're indigent? What if they haven't worked and they haven't filed a tax return? What form do we need to verify that information?
Dr. Leanne, do you want to answer that, or do you want me to?
I would defer that to you, Mary, unless you want me to see if Brock's available.
Oh. So one thing I would do is refer you to our registration guides that are posted on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website. Yeah, and also there are some Rule 132 questions that are posted on the DHS DMH website that deal with eligibility and income, so you can always check those. No, we would be looking for W-2 forms, paycheck stubs. We do recognize sometimes, however, a consumer may not give you the documentation that you need, no matter how much you ask them for it, you know, and point out that we need the information. In that instance, there is a qualifying exception that you can use to enter that information on the registration, along with an income of zero. You know, we don't expect providers to use it often, but we do recognize that there are some times when you can't get that information, even though you've made a concerted effort to do so.
Okay, so if I have a patient that is on Social Security disability, you still want proof of that income?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have another question from Mr. Gongmin Mo. Sir, you may begin.
Yeah, Dr. Mary Smith, I just want to ask a question, actually more like a plea on behalf of my, you know, the providers I work with, including my own agency. You know, about 2 or 3 years ago, we started this authorization procedure. And I was asking to see whether you can have a plan to do a batch authorization. Because if you look at the authorization, you know, more than half of the information is in client registration. That's how we already have it. And at that time, you guys mentioned maybe there is a possibility of doing that. I don't know whether this is still on your project to be done, or you have any plan or any, because I keep getting, you know, people ask me this.
Yeah, Gongmin, thanks for the reminder. We have not worked on it. We've had other projects that we've had to direct our attention to. But I'll take a look at that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. There are no questions on queue, ma'am. You may proceed.
All right. At this time, we will move into utilization management requests for services process. And I will turn the call over to Sue Kappas.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kappas. I am the Clinical Services Manager at the Collaborative. Next section, we'll walk through the process of submitting utilization management requests for services through the use of...
Excuse me, Sue. This is Amy. We can barely hear you.
Okay. Is that any better?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Okay. We will start with ACT and CST services. The process for ACT and CST. DMH requires the collaborative to respond to requests for authorizations within one business day of receiving a complete initial authorization request and 3 business days for a complete re-auth request. That does exclude holidays and weekends. You can submit your request for ACT in 2 different ways. You can submit it online at the IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com/providers.htm, or you can fax it to us at 866-928-7177. To request an initial authorization for a consumer, the provider will submit a packet. And depending on whether you're requesting ACT or CST, the packet will include either the ACT authorization request form that includes locus information for adults, you're submitting for CST, that form includes locus information as well as Ohio scale results for children that are ages 5 through 17 if you're requesting CST for a child. The package should also include a treatment plan, the consumer's initial crisis plan, and a mental health assessment. So once the initial ACT request is submitted, the documents are reviewed for adherence to medical necessity criteria and Rule 132. If the clinical criteria are met for services, the collaborative clinician will enter an authorization for 3 months of service if only an MHA is submitted at that time. However, if a treatment plan is submitted at the time of the initial, the clinician will enter an authorization for up to 12 months instead of the abbreviated 3 month off. Now for CST, the time frames are slightly different. A clinician will authorize 6 months if a treatment plan is submitted and 3 months if an MHA is submitted at the time of the initial. To request a reauth for ACT or CST, you'll submit the ACT or the CST auth request form, and on that form you'll include updated locus or Ohio score information. At the time of the reauth, you'll need the updated treatment plan and a crisis plan. And once again, the clinical documentation will be reviewed for adherence to Rule 132, and the clinician will enter an authorization for 9 or 12 months of ACT services and 6 months for CST. You can request a reauth within 14 calendar days of the authorization expiring. The next two slides are examples of a request for authorization form for ACT, and there's one for CST, and these can both be found on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative's website. I just want to point out on those forms for the one for ACT, the date the ACT services start, just make sure that you indicate that on the form. Top portion asks for all of your agency information, the name of the consumer, date of birth, RIN. It doesn't show it on this slide, but there is actually a place on the form for a transition plan, and you would use that section to describe a clinical need for transition to either a less intensive service or a more intensive service. So at some point, if your consumer is moving from, let's say, ACT to CST or vice versa. This next section demonstrates how to enter an authorization through Provider Connect. So you will log on to Provider Connect, and you can enter the authorization from either link, the one there in the middle of the page or the one over to the left. Read the disclaimer page and select Next. Brings you to the member search page. You'll enter required fields. You'll need the consumer's ID or RIN, date of birth. That will bring you to the member demographics page. Just verify that all of that information is correct. Select Next. Bring you to the provider location. You will select your agency's address. And that will bring you to the request for services page. First box there on the left is requested start date. You will enter the date that you need the ACT, this is an example of ACT, the date you'd need the ACT services to start. The type of service is mental health. The level of care, there's a drop down there. You'll choose assertive community treatment. And from the level of service drop down, you would choose outpatient. And if you're submitting through the web, this is the page where you would upload all of your supporting documents in this section. The next screen, you would complete the clinical staff contact information. If you could make sure that you're putting down the clinical staff's name, there are times when we do have to call clinicians if we need additional information. Should we enter a phone number and a fax number? That would be great. The next screen is the service definition criteria. You will check all that apply. And if you're requesting ACT, there is a section on there that asks for acute inpatient episodes in the prior 12 months. The next screen is the diagnoses. This all pre-populates from your registration. All five of the axes do need to be filled out. The current GAF score is pre-populated, but you will need to enter the highest GAF score in the past year. Next screen is the LOCUS results. That also pre-populates from registration. There is a section for reason for deviation for ACT. Looking for a composite score around 20 to 22 or a level 4. If that score deviates either way, then you would enter that. If you could explain that in that narrative history box, it does hold 200 characters. The next screen is medication. Complete all of the psychotropic medication that the consumer takes. There's drop-down for medication name. You would enter the dosage, the frequency, any side effects, and who prescribes it. And the last screen, the determination status screen. Down at the bottom, it shows you the different options. You can print your authorization results from here. You can print the auth request. You can download the auth request. And you can return to provider home. If you're going to discontinue ACT and CST services, providers must notify the collaborative when a consumer is discontinuing ACT or CST services by completing a notification of discontinuation of ACT or CST services form and faxing it to the collaborative. Detailed information regarding discontinuance of ACT or CST service and linkage to other services must be documented in the consumer's record. And the next couple of slides are examples of the notice of discontinuation for ACT, CST, which can be found on the collaborative's website. You will check off the reason for the discontinuation. And again, there is a space there. It's real important. ACT was discontinued. You could make sure that you're entering the date they are discontinued. And with that, I will turn it over to Renee Potter, the UM team lead.
Good afternoon. This is Renee. I'm going to talk a little bit about Hi, this is Renee. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the process of requesting authorization for therapy counseling, community support group, as well as psychosocial rehab. We are required to process your authorization request within 7 business days. That's excluding, of course, holidays and weekends. All of the requests are to be submitted via Provider Connect. Any supporting clinical can be attached, or it can be faxed to 866-928-7177. Once the clinical has been received, it'll be checked by our clinicians for completeness as well as that it's consistent. If the diagnosis or the locus from submitted documentation doesn't match the pre-populated information from the registration, our clinical care manager will have to call the clinician to get clarification. If the clinical does meet medical needs criteria and it adheres to Rule 132 and we determine that it's complete, we will then put an authorization in place and you will receive an authorization letter. If medical necessity criteria has not been met, the clinical care manager will contact the provider for some clarification and offer some education on the specific criteria that has not been met. The clinician will try to reach an agreement with the provider regarding the next steps, regarding submission of perhaps some additional clinical and or an alternative level of care or services for this client. If an agreement isn't reached because the provider believes that medical needs criteria has been met, the clinician will then present all that clinical information to one of our physician advisors to make a determination. We will go into more detail later in the presentation on the process of having one of our physician advisors review a case. So that's pretty much a high-level overview of what we are looking for the process of an authorization request. So we're going to get back into the specifics, as Sue had done with the ACT and CST, as to actually how to go into Provider Connect and make that request. You're going to go to the authorization request page. You can enter your request in 2 different locations. Next, you're going to go to the disclaimer page. You're going to read and move through that. Next, we got the member search page. Again, the RIN number and the date of birth is what's required. Then you're going to move on over to the member demographics page, verify info, and then we're going to move on over to the provider location screen, choose your address, and then we're going to move on over to the requested services header. And now, with the type of request that you're going to be asking for therapy counseling, PSR and CSG, you're going to want to choose, you know, outpatient as a service level and mental health as the type, as well as the level of care. And in this example, we have therapy and counseling. This is also where you can attach supporting documents, such as an individual treatment plan, a detailed progress of the goals, as well as a detailed transition plan. Submitting these documents is not required, but it's very helpful for the clinical care manager to make their determination. In this next section, please document the name and the phone number of the individual clinician that the clinical care manager can contact if they have any clarifying questions. And next, for the diagnosis, when entering the Access 1 and 2 diagnosis, please make sure that it matches any documents that you're submitting. Continued with the diagnosis, make sure that you're entering the medication as it's prescribed. If the consumer is not on any medication, you can choose the option of other, and then you can actually type NA or none. If you indicate there isn't any medication, then we won't have to call and ask for that information. And then moving on down to the locus. When entering the locus, please enter any reason for deviation in the narrative box if the locus is above or below the recommended level of care, as well as with moving on to the Ohio score for, you know, folks 5 to 17, you know, please put in the problem score versus the sum of the problem and function score. Also, please indicate if any attached documents or have been faxed in, because these are required fields as well. And then for under the service requested page, please enter the start and end date with the accurate amount of units that you're looking for. For these services, we are not able to backdate the request. They are effective the date the request is submitted. And again, for the amount of units that you are requesting, 1 hour is equal to 4 units. And then on the discharge and transition plan, you can enter in what program or community-based supports, if they're known, because that's required information for us to document. And then you're going to need to enter the amount of days that you anticipate before the consumer will discharge from the program. You're going to need to check off any barriers that you are anticipating for discharge. And then you get on all the way down to the narrative box. And this box holds a total of 2,000 characters. And in this box, if you're not submitting documentation, we're going to ask you to enter information to substantiate your request for services. We are using this information, of course, to determine the medical needs criteria that it has been met per Rule 132. And you know, it's been discussed earlier that this document is on the DHS website. I encourage you guys to look at it and understand what it is that we're looking for. And if you're not faxing in the info in this narrative box, please, as concisely as possible, let us know the reason for this request, the current symptoms the consumer's experiencing, what are the specific time-limited goals and objectives. This is important to be very clear to document, especially with our PSR requests. If we are not getting that information faxed or attached, it needs to be very clearly documented in this box, as well as the specific progress that has been made with each goal and objective, and also how are they benefiting from the treatment being provided, and then a specific transition plan, not just the discharge goal, saying that once they, you know, meet this goal, they'll be discharged. We want to know specifically what sort of supports will be in place for them to maintain the therapeutic gains. Will they, you know, be interacting with the church group? Will they be going to AA? That's the type of information that we're going to be looking for. And so then that gets us to the determination page. And, you know, that's going to let you know that your request is pending and that we're looking that over at this point to make a determination. And then again, at the bottom of this page, you have options to print different documents. So now I'm going to turn it over to Brett Sparlin. He's our higher level of care team manager. He'll talk a little bit more about administrative and clinical denials.
Okay. Thank you, Renee. We're going to briefly address the administrative denial process. The most common reasons for an administrative denial are listed there. Primarily, the most that we deal with is that they are not currently Medicaid enrolled, but it could also be that the provider did not request or respond to our request for additional information, or the request is not received within the required time frame, or the activity is not consistent with Rule 59 of the Administrative Code 132. Providers will receive a call informing you that the request has been administratively denied, as well as a letter which will outline the steps for an appeal. In order to appeal a denial, generally speaking, the denial is because the consumer did not meet medical needs criteria, and you can check the link up there with the state of Illinois with Rule 132. The clinician will notify the provider as to why the consumer does not meet criteria and will explain the next steps. The clinician will offer an option to negotiate a decreased amount of units or a shorter authorization period. This is in order, specifically with PSR, in order to ensure that there is an effective discharge or transition plan that could be enacted. If there is no agreement that can be reached between the clinician and the provider, the clinician will present the consumer's clinical information to an Illinois board-certified psychiatrist for a determination at what is called the second-level review. If that psychiatrist denies the authorization request because the consumer does not meet medical needs criteria, the provider does have the right to ask for a reconsideration request within 30 days of the second-level review determination. Another Illinois board-certified psychiatrist will conduct the reconsideration request. If the second psychiatrist upholds the decision made by the first psychiatrist, the provider does have one last recourse, and that's with a DMH secretary appeal review. With the DMH secretary, let me back step once. With the reconsideration request, the clinician or the providers can submit additional clinical information for review. However, with the DMH secretary appeal review, that is not possible. You cannot submit additional clinical information. To request a DMH secretary appeal review, you have 5 days within the notification of the reconsideration request denial letter, and that must be submitted in writing to DMH. Whatever decision DMH makes, that is the final decision. The provider will receive a call from the clinician on the day of the determination, explaining the process, and the providers will receive a letter of denial within 5 to 7 business days. As far as technical issues, like the first number to always keep in mind with technical issues is to call the EDI help desk at 888-247-9311 and select prompt 1. They are open from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, Monday through Friday. Typical examples of technical issues are, you know, your account is disabled, forgot a password, system freezes or crashes, system's unavailable due to errors, or registration concerns. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Amy for any further presentations.
All right. Thank you, Brent. Operator, we can now open the line for questions at this time.
All right. Once again, press star 1 and record your name clearly. One moment, please. There are no questions on queue at this point, ma'am. You may proceed. Oh, I'm sorry. We have Mr. Gongmin Mo.
Sir, your line is open. Okay, thank you. I just want to, tell people one of my observations regarding the utilization management and the service authorization is because everybody is pre-authorized, like for pre-authorized hours for PSR, community support, and individual therapy. And then suppose you have like 10 hours individual therapy, you want to reauthorize before the 10-hour use. So probably like 8 hours or 7 hour use, then you do seek reauthorization. Originally, a lot of people think, you know, I use 7 hours or 3 hours left. Now I get approved for additional 5 hours. Altogether, I have 8 hours. But that's not true because based on our experience, you know, we confirm with the Provider Connect is that once you get the new authorization, your old authorization unit are invalid. So I just want to mention to people because we got a lot of users, you know, get confused on this.
Thank you. We have a question from Ms. Vicky Tello. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, this might be backing up a little bit, but in serving an undocumented population, I know that in Provider Connect we can say the Social Security and certain information is unknown and proceed, but are we going to be able to submit claims and process services for these individuals?
You should be, as long as you complete the registration. You know, as you noted, there are certainly some, for many of the data elements that we collect, you will be able to indicate not applicable or choose some other appropriate response. So, we still expect you to provide as much of the data and complete the registration as fully as possible, but that should not stop you from submitting a claim. Now, of course, the individual has to have a RIN number and they have to be Medicaid enrolled. You know, that's a given.
So if they're undocumented, which means they probably cannot get access to a RIN, that would negate us from being able to treat them, correct?
I would say yes, I'm not sure if HFS has something else going on, but in order to bill for these services, to bill DMH for these services, the folks on this call are expected to only provide services to individuals who are enrolled in Medicaid. I don't know how else we would pay you.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. There are no questions in queue, ma'am. You may continue.
Dr. Smith, we are running a little ahead of schedule. Would you like to go into submission of claims, or would you like to take a break at this time?
Well, my presentation isn't all that long with regard to the submission of claims, so with the indulgence of the folks on the phone, I think if we just go ahead, we'll be able to free people up maybe 45 minutes earlier than planned. I'm sure people would appreciate that. Okay, so let's just go into submission of claims. You know, I don't have any, it's Mary Smith again, I don't have any slides for you, but there are a couple of points that I want to make, and then I have some resources to point you to. So during our earlier presentation, when Trish Gorda talked about submitting the batch registrations, And this is even for the Provider Connect registrations that Amy talked about. You know, before you submit claims, if you haven't gotten the idea that these registrations are important, they are, because, again, your registrations must be submitted and they must be accepted before you can submit claims. So it is very important, it's actually critical, that you review the response files that you receive from the collaborative so that you know whether or not your registration has been accepted. So can't emphasize that enough. If you just start submitting, you know, if you just take it for granted that everything's accepted and you start submitting claims, pretty much the only thing that's going to happen is that you're going to get a lot of error reports. And the remittance advice is paper, so that may lead you to go through a lot of information in order to, you know, just basically find out that your registration was not accepted. The collaborative, we've worked with HFS. The collaborative sends information to HFS on a daily basis containing registration and other information that's required to process claims. And so this includes not only information about the registrations and the eligibility groups into which individuals fit, it also includes information about authorizations. So pursuant to state legislation a couple of years ago, any provider who provides services that DMH purchases must submit their claims directly to HFS. Over the last few years, DMH and the Collaborative have worked directly with HFS to put into place business requirements that govern the processing of all claims. And so, again, it's important that you make sure, you know, if you want to provide, you know, one of the services that needs prior authorization, like ACT and CST, it's incredibly important to make sure those authorizations are in place before you start submitting claims, and to make sure that you don't provide those services until they are authorized. We have some examples of folks who submitted claims for ACT or CST prior to the authorization, and then they were a little puzzled about why their claims were rejected. They were rejected because there was no authorization in place. And so there's really no way to fix that. So let's make sure everything is authorized before proceeding. I've already talked about the information that goes back and that is passed on to HFS on a daily basis. You know, basically the business requirements that are needed to process claims have been developed as edits in the HFS system, and so those edits are applied automatically before any claim is processed. In terms of submitting claims, you know, I think most people, most agencies or providers on this call have submitted claims before. You know, I know that you're just enrolling as Rule 132 providers, so you probably know this, but I'll just say it anyway. You can certainly always submit claims through batch processing, or you can submit it through the MEDI portal that is maintained by HFS. And I'll talk in a minute about the provider manual that relates to that. Another key and critical thing, again, most of you probably already know this, but I always find it's helpful to remind people. Pursuant to the SMART Act, providers have up to 180 days to submit a clean claim from the date of service. And so that's really important to keep in mind. You know, it's another reason that you always want to check and make sure your registrations and authorizations are in place. You know, the last thing you want to do is submit a claim close to that 180 days and then find that there's an error and it's not processed. Once you get past that 180-day point, you won't be able to resubmit that claim because, again, you have 180 days to submit a clean claim. Claims are submitted using the standardized 5010 format. Some folks may still refer to it as the 837P. There is one piece of specialized information that relates to DMH that needs to be submitted. It's in loop 2400. This information is referenced on the HFS webpage under medical providers. The companion guide, which again, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but just as a reminder, the companion guide for the 5010 is posted on the HFS website under EDI, Electronic Data Exchange. There's also the HFS provider handbook. And so there are specific errors that relate to the claims processing that HFS does for DMH. You'll find the definitions for those error codes in Chapter 100. I think it's Appendix 5. But again, that information is posted on the HFS website. It's possible to receive a remittance advice from HFS. It's the 835. I believe right now it's in paper format only. I think you may have to sign up for that, but you'll probably want to check with the HFS billing consultants if you're not familiar with that. Again, I'm guessing that you probably are, and you're probably already signed up for it. But if you're not, it's good to be signed up for it. Probably a year ago, providers had to wait until the claims were actually processed, adjudicated, and paid by the comptroller in order to receive an 835. HFS changed that probably, I don't know, 5-6 months ago, and they actually issue remittance advices, I think, within a week of processing the claim. Of course, if you don't, if you want more immediate feedback, I guess, after the claim is processed, you can look up claims individually again through the HFS MEDI portal. If you're not signed up for provider notices with HFS, you'll definitely want to do that, because if there are any changes with regard to claim submission, you'll get a notice from the HFS webmaster advising you of that. If there are changes that, you know, that have some special change for DMH providers, DMH will often also send out a communication alert just letting folks know that there is a provider notice for something pertaining to DMH. But I would want to emphasize that you shouldn't really count on that, because those provider notices are actually HFS notices. So be sure to sign up for those if you don't already. If you have any questions with regard to the submission of claims, we have various steps that you should really go through. The first step is always to give the HFS claims consultants a call after you've reviewed the claim to see if you can troubleshoot what's wrong. I'm pretty sure that Leanne talked about this yesterday, or another DMH staff person, the Service Definition Reimbursement Guide that's published by HFS. The current copy was published in 2011. Right now it resides on the HFS website as well as the DMH website. A new one is imminent, so there will be a 2014 SDRG, or Service Definition Reimbursement Guide. So that contains detailed information, again, as I'm sure folks talked about yesterday, containing operational definitions for all of the Rule 132 services, as well as information about qualifications of staff who provide the services, as well as the type of units that can be billed for and the amount that providers will be reimbursed for the service. We also have on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website at www.illinoismentalhealthcollaborative.com, if you go through the provider portal and then select provider information, there's really a wealth of information. You know, again, this is where you'll find the registration guides that were referred to earlier. There's training material out there. We've done this training a couple of times. And then there's also a service matrix that's posted out there. The intent of the service matrix is to give providers a shortcut. It's a sort of a handy spreadsheet that shows you all of the services that DMH purchases. Again, it shows the modifiers that are required, the staffing levels, the amounts that are paid for each service, the location where services can be rendered, and then there's a little column under MCD, which stands for Medicaid, which shows you the services that you can submit claims for. So it doesn't contain really anything different than the Service Definition Reimbursement Guide, but it's a handy Excel spreadsheet that you can use to look up that information at a glance, as opposed to going to the SDRG. You know, of course, if you want the detailed information, you'll need to go to that guide. So it's important, you know, I guess just in summary, it's important to check the status of claims processing. We know that claims bills can be paid a little bit slow through the state. one of the things that you don't want to do is, you know, submit claims and then really not check on their status. Everything should work fine. Claims should be processed and adjudicated, and you should receive your 835 remittance advice. But it's always a bad idea not to go out there and check the status of claims just in the event that something has gone awry. You know, again, you want to beat that 180 days timeline for submitting claims. So, again, you can check the processing of your claims through the 835 remittance advice that's issued by HFS. You can go and take a look at the HFS Medi system and spot check some individual claims. And then also the Collaborative and DMH have developed on-demand reports that are available through the Provider Connect portal that Amy described earlier. You know, if you're new to our system, if you go out there and take a look, and also if you just take a look again at the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website, there is some training material out there that relates to training that we've done with providers on how to run those reports. Of course, in order to run the reports, whoever's running them needs to have access to Provider Connect, and they need to have an ID so that they can run those reports. Many providers find those reports useful because there are several different kinds of reports. The claims reports, you can actually run a report, download the information into an Excel file, and then manipulate it that way. There are also registration reports out there that you can run, and it'll help you check the status of your registrations. In fact, there are some reports that let you know, you know, if an individual is coming close to time for re-registration. So, let's say you submit your claims and then you find that there is an error from one of these sources that I just described. Again, first step is to review the errors. You know, you can certainly look to see what the error message says that's on the remittance advice. Sometimes everything's not on there, though. There's a better explanation in Chapter 100 of the provider guide that's provided by HFS. So if you look at Chapter 100 and look up the error code, it might be possible for you to troubleshoot the error yourself and figure out what's wrong. If that happens, make the correction and then resubmit the claim as soon as possible. You know, if you look at the error guide and you can't figure out what the error is, please don't hesitate to contact the HFS billing consultants. The reason they're there is for you to call and let them know that you have a problem with a claim, with a DMH claim, and you can't figure out what the problem is and you need some assistance in problem solving it so that you can remediate the problem and then resubmit the claim as soon as possible. So over the past few years, DMH, the Collaborative, and HFS have established, I think, a really good process to review and assist providers in remediating these errors. So we exchange information on a daily basis or as often as needed in order to help providers resolve these problems. And the reason we put this process in place is so that you don't have to, you know, sit in your agency or in your office and say, who do I call about this? We've centralized the process so that there, you know, there's a starting place for you to enter into and have that information exchanged back and forth between HFS, the Collaborative, and DMH so that we can figure out what the problem is and help you resolve it as soon as possible. Let's see what else. One of the things that I'll reiterate, I think I've said this, it's really important to contact the billing consultants if you need assistance right away. If you wait until, you know, 160 days have passed and there's a real problem with the claim, one of the things that the consultants look at and that DMH looks at is how soon you contacted them to help resolve the problem. You know, so if you have a whole lot of billing problems and you wait until just about the 180 days are up, it's going to be very difficult to help you remediate the problem and then resubmit clean claims within that 180-day period. So it's really up to you to make sure that you're looking at the sources that I described earlier, again, to just make sure your claims are processing and that there are no errors out there that are going to keep you from receiving payment for the services that you provide to individuals who really need mental health services. I guess in closing, the only other thing that I would remind you is please do not hold off in submitting registrations or claims. Although you have a 90-day period to submit a registration, typically it doesn't really take 90 days to gather the information to submit a registration. When I worked at a community mental health center, most of the time when you interact with an individual, you can get most of the information that you need, certainly within a week or 2 weeks. To submit your registration. You can always go back in and update it if there's something missing. And then again, once you've got that registration in, there's really no reason to hold claims. I would have a regular schedule for submitting claims, you know, whether it's weekly or every 2 weeks or whatever, but you just really need to make sure you get those claims out. So I think that is it. Amy, I think we're ready to take questions.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Smith. Operator, we can please open the lines at this time for questions.
All right. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question and record your name clearly. One moment, please. We have Ms. Margaret Holden. Ma'am, you may proceed.
Hi. I have a question. We're a brand-new facility, and we're waiting on our certification with 8 beds. With that being said, with me being the revenue cycle analyst, how, in your experience, what would you recommend and how often to bill? Once a week to stay on top of it? Every 2 weeks?
Personally, I would try to bill every week.
That's what I was thinking, too. The faster the turnaround time, so therefore if the registration is open that much quicker, we'll get the information that much faster and submit the claim that much faster.
Yep, exactly.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Next is Ms. Brittany Lopez. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi. I was wondering if we get the Community Mental Health Center, if we can bill DASA clients.
You would have to have a contract with DASA to bill for DASA clients.
Okay, we're currently DASA licensed. Would we need an additional certification?
I guess I'm not sure what you're asking.
Okay, so we already have a DASA license and we do DASA work, but we don't get DASA funding. Does CMHC help with that?
No. You would need to work with DASA around being able to bill for substance abuse services. You can only bill Rule 132 services for people, for individuals who meet our eligibility criteria.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question, star 2 to withdraw your request.
Well, Amy, if there are no questions, looks like we have about 50 minutes back to do other things.
Yes.
Yeah. If there are no questions in queue, ma'am, you may proceed.
All right. If there are no more questions in queue, then that will conclude our call for today. I would like to remind the audience that today's call audio and presentation will be posted under the Provider Resources heading on the Provider Information page of the Collaborative's website. The audio will be in MP3 format and ready for download within 2 to 3 business days. I would also like to remind everyone that we value your feedback, so please take a few minutes to complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out the online forum today. Allie, please push the speakers through to post-conference, and you may now disconnect the main line.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.